I consider you to be one of my best friends.
The government plays phone recordings of Ted Stevens and Bill Allen. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 6th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the legislature prepares to hear testimony from state officials on Troopergate.
The real object is just to get their side of the story and let them tell us what happened in as efficient and timely a fashion as possible.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
Jurors in the trial of Alaska Senator Ted Stevens listened this morning to three audio recordings of conversations between Stevens and former VECO CEO Bill Allen. Allen is the government's main witness as prosecutors try to build a case that Stevens took more than $250,000 worth of gifts, mostly from VECO. One of the alleged major gifts is the renovation of Stevens' Girdwood home. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
Bill Allen was confronted by the FBI in August of 2006 and given an option to cooperate with their investigation into political corruption in Alaska, and in turn, his children would receive immunity from prosecution. Allen agreed. The very next day, the FBI recorded a phone call between Allen and his old friend, Ted Stevens.
Hello.
Hey, Bill.
Yeah, Ted.
I'm in San Francisco now.
Allen breaks the news to Stevens that the FBI has searched Allen's house looking for information about Stevens' son, Ben Stevens, who is serving in the Alaska State Senate.
The FBI got a warrant and searched my house and the office.
For what?
With Ben. And trying to figure out, you know, what kind of, you know, what he done for us.
I see. Okay.
And they asked me what I'd done on your house.
Yeah.
And I said, at least paid for everything. And you don't need this problem again, Ted. But that's what they're talking to me, and I just told them I wouldn't talk to them.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Well, I'll talk to Catherine. We'll figure that out. But an inkling something's up, Bill. I don't know what it is.
Allen says the FBI is asking him about labor charges on the house and who paid for them. And Stevens again says he'll talk to his wife, Catherine, about it. Stevens' lawyers say she was the one handling the bills on the home renovation. In a second call less than 2 weeks later, Stevens encourages Allen to stay positive and physically healthy and uses curse words to describe the government investigators.
Well, I'm not getting much sleep, but I think about all this that's going down about 4 hours a night, but I'm going to survive. I just can't figure out why these are doing this thing to our friends, but and Bob and Ben and you and I seem to be the chief targets right now.
Stevens is talking about their mutual friend Bob Persons in Girdwood, who allegedly helped with the Stevens house renovation, and Stevens' son Ben. In the third tape, made a month later, in mid-October of 2006, Stevens warns Allen that they can't talk about the situation, so they're not charged with obstruction of justice. He references Martha Stewart, who 2 years earlier was convicted for what Stevens describes as not having done anything, but for lying about a conversation she had. Stevens warns that the FBI could be listening to them. He proclaims numerous times he believes they're both innocent. Stevens sounds invigorated and defiant, while Allen sounds downtrodden. Stevens gives him multiple pep talks.
You got to get a mental attitude that these guys can't really hurt us. You know, they're not going to shoot us. It's not at Iraq. So what the hell? Worst can happen to us is we run a bunch of legal fees and might lose, and we might have to pay a fine, might have to serve a little time in jail. I hope to Christ it never gets to that, but I don't think it will. But I mean, I'm developing the attitude that I don't think I did anything wrong, so I'm going to go right through my life and keep doing what I think is right.
Stevens tells Allen that he won't visit him because of the investigation. He tells Allen to keep his chin up.
Someone say, Bill, how's it going? Tell him it's going pretty good. I don't know what this thing's going to be, but it's a good life, isn't it? Just tell him it's a good life. No matter what they do, it's a good life.
Okay.
Quiet, buddy.
I will.
Okay.
Hey, Chad.
Yeah.
I love you, you know.
Bill, I consider you to be one of my best friends. I'd be over there in a minute if I didn't feel the lawyer said was right, and I might hurt you by trying to listen to you now, and you're telling me things I should know.
Yeah.
I'll find him out in time. If we need him, your lawyer will share him with my lawyer. But right now, let's play this game so straight that they can't accuse us of one damn thing other than what these other guys have charged us with, which ain't true.
Stephen's lawyers are trying to show the jury that Allen was the one lying about bills and that gifts he gave Stephens were unwanted. They had their chance to cross-examine the government's key witness Monday. Stephen's lawyers asked Allen if he'd ever bribed the senator. Allen said no. The defense attorney asked Allen if Stephens paid his part of the bill when the two dined together or when they traveled together. Allen said yes, he did. He also said extravagant Christmas lights were a surprise for Stephens, and furniture Allen put in the Stephens home was his own idea and not something he asked Stephens permission to do. The lawyer pointed out that Stephens' feet didn't even touch the ground when he sat in one of the seats. Allen also said when he saw one of the bills for the renovation, he did not want to give it to the Stephens couple because it was too high, so they never saw it. Allen also said he didn't bill Stephens for heat tape put on the roof because it was installed to correct a design flaw, which Allen felt bad about. Stephens' lawyers will finish cross-examining him Tuesday morning. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Several times now, Ted Stephens' legal team has asked Judge Emmett Sullivan to dismiss the case, contending that federal prosecution has been deliberately withholding evidence from the defense. The judge has said he will rule on the latest dismissal motion tomorrow or Wednesday, and he ordered prosecutors to provide more complete documents to the defense. Those documents contain some new details about the Alaska corruption cases the FBI has been investigating, APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
In other trials, VCO owner Bill Allen has testified that Ted Stephens' son Ben was one of the state legislators he bribed. Ben Stephens was president of the state Senate when Allen was trying to get terms favorable to the oil industry into a rewrite of the state's tax laws. He has not been charged. Allen testified that Ben Stephens was a VCO consultant before he was appointed to the state Senate, and the company simply kept him on the payroll after he became a senator. The documents made public today add to that story. They are summaries filed for prosecutors by FBI investigators, and they show Allen telling them that a number of VCO executives were concerned because once he was in the Senate, Stephens was no longer doing anything to earn his consulting fee, at times as much as $10,000 a month. This continued right up to August of 2006 when the FBI made its deal with Allen for him to cooperate and got search warrants for the offices of state legislators. That's when the invoices from Ben Stephens to VCO stopped, say the documents. The interview notes from that August 30th interview with Allen are wide-ranging and include a lot of legislative names not previously mentioned, though sometimes it's just a peripheral reference, like Allen's memory of having purchased a lodge from former state Senator Rick Halford for $270,000, which Allen believed was about market value. That's different from another property he bought from former state Senator Jerry Ward for $30,000, which Allen called inflated and really a scheme to get Ward campaign money. Allen also told the agent that he dated Ward's daughter and paid to remodel her home. Another name mentioned as having been paid as a VCO consultant was former state Senator Robin Taylor, though Allen said that was some time ago. The documents mention former Representative Cheryl Hines, who Allen said asked him for a job for her or her husband, Harold. Allen said he turned her down, suspecting a setup. Allen told the agent he gave money to former Representative Bev Masick whenever she asked for it. Masick got in trouble for using campaign money for personal expenses. Allen said he got VCO attorney Jack Miller to give her legal help in dealing with the APOC complaint. She lost the case. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a settlement on one issue surrounding the polar bear listing controversy.
This agreement is one of the stepping stones towards getting the type of protection that we need to make sure that polar bears make it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Division of Elections reminds voters that Tuesday, November 4th, is Election Day. Polling places will be open from 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. To find your polling place, call 1-888-383-8683. If you need language or other assistance while voting, you may ask the election board or bring a person of your choice to assist you. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Division of Elections.
Attorney General Talis Kolberg this weekend said that all seven state employees who were subpoenaed by the Senate Judiciary Committee will give depositions to the investigator looking into the firing of Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan. They had withheld their testimony in the inquiry until a court ruled on the validity of the subpoenas, which has now been completed, although an appeal by some plaintiffs to the Alaska Supreme Court will be taken up Wednesday. Senator Hollis French says the seven state workers will be allowed to give written statements under oath to help speed up the process.
The real object is just to get their side of the story and let them tell us what happened in as efficient and timely a fashion as possible. And given Mr. Branchflower's workload and the short time frame available, this seemed like the most efficient and the most fair to both sides.
A report on the investigation is due to the Legislative Council this Friday. Investigator Steve Branchflower has been working on the report for approximately 3 months in an attempt to find out if there is evidence of abuse of power by the Palin administration. Information has been made public by Governor Palin showing that there could have been pressure on Monaghan by members of her staff who wanted the governor's former brother-in-law fired from his job as a trooper. Branchflower will be paid $45,000 for the investigation and report. A contentious catch-sharing plan for Alaska halibut harvesters has gained the approval of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. As APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports, conflicts between commercial halibut fishermen and the guided sport charter fleet have a long history. The new plan will apply to both southeast and south-central Alaska.
Public testimony went on for days before the council got down to deliberations on a catch-sharing plan for halibut harvesters in southeast and south-central Alaska. The council heard comments like this one from Juneau's commercial fisherman, Chris McDowell.
In any case, I'd like to see the council vigorously pursue an effective and timely catch accounting mechanism for the charter industry that will allow that industry to be managed to their allocation or their GHL, whichever it may be, but to manage them to that allocation in season. That's really essential, particularly in 2C. The sector has substantially exceeded that several years in a row.
And charter operator Rick Bierman.
I represent the Juneau Charter Boat Operators Association. We support the charter sector alternative proposal. We helped develop it. We support it because we feel without a 2-halibut bag limit, our clients will go elsewhere to fish. We have plenty of hard evidence to support this belief. At one fish or less, multi-day vessel and lodge-based operators in 2C will die.
Further questions? Mr. Merrigan. Rick, you said what we have in front of us doesn't address the problem. We have a problem statement. It talks about the absence of an allocation between the two sectors.
A motion offered by Petersburg's Jerry Merrigan, a commercial fisherman and council member, passed a council vote 10-1 Saturday evening. The action establishes an annual combined allocation for charter and commercial operators in southeast and south-central Alaska. The measure provides southeast area 2C and south-central area 3A each a percentage of the allocation and requests the International Pacific Halibut Commission to set a combined catch limit for the charter and setline sectors in each area. The action also locks in place management plans for the charter sector based on combined charter and setline catch amounts. Linda Benkin represents the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association.
This motion very clearly expresses that it's the council intent that the charter fleet will be managed to remain below those allocations. It sets a framework for a more responsive management system. So if they trigger by going over boundaries, management measure change to bring them back down under that allocation.
Commercial halibut fishermen have for years pressed managers to curb the growth of the charter fleet's take of halibut because the sport angler catch affects commercial catch limits, which are based on halibut abundance and are set by an international commission. But the new plan could result in lower bag limits for the charter fleet in cases when the combined catch limit is low. And charter operators say a one fish bag limit will hurt their businesses. Earl Comstock is counsel for the Charter Halibut Task Force.
We're very disappointed in the outcome. It's apparent that the commercial interests control the council, and even the state of Alaska was unsuccessful in finding a more balanced approach. The provisions that have been put in place really only benefit the commercial industry and come at the expense of the recreational angler.
The catch-sharing plan also allows charter operators to purchase unused halibut quota share from commercial fishermen. The council's action must be approved by the U.S. Secretary of Commerce. Lloyd says if approved, it won't go into effect before 2011. The council spent the better part of 4 days on the issue. A number of items on this session's council agenda were bumped due to time constraints. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Environmental groups announced today they've reached an agreement with the federal government over some of their concerns surrounding the recent Endangered Species Act listing for the polar bear. Under the settlement, the Interior Department will designate critical habitat for the species. The move wouldn't automatically prohibit oil and gas drilling in the designated habitat area, but it would make it much more difficult. Melanie Duchin is a global warming campaigner in Anchorage for Greenpeace, one of the conservation groups that reached the settlement.
This agreement is really important. It's one of the pieces in the puzzle and one of the stepping stones towards getting the type of protection that we need to make sure that polar bears make it into the 21st century.
The federal government has until June 30th, 2010 to set a final rule defining the polar bear's critical habitat. Before then, the Interior Department will release a proposal that will be subject to public review. Duchin says Greenpeace would like the designation to include a broad area.
I'd like to see most of the Chukchi Sea, if not all the Chukchi Sea, and the Beaufort Sea set out as critical habitat, because that's where we have two populations of polar bears. There are 19 populations in the world. Alaska has two of them, one in the Chukchi and one in the Beaufort. And we can't just protect part of their habitat. We have to protect all of it because polar bears really are at great risk from global warming.
The Interior Department has also agreed to issue guidelines that would call for using non-lethal methods to deter polar bears that threaten public safety. But the agreement doesn't address all of the conservation group's concerns. The polar bear was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, but the conservation group says an endangered listing is necessary given the plight of the species. They also say global warming pollution should be included in the list of threats the polar bear is facing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the new AT&T, your world delivered. Alaska Quarterly Review is recognized as one of the nation's best literary magazines. Among the features of the 2008 issue is Joshua Castile's play Returns, about the war in Iraq from Castile's unique perspective as an interrogator and Arabic interpreter at Abu Ghraib Prison. Copies are available at select bookstores or by subscription. Alaska Quarterly Review is edited by Ronald Spatz and published by the University of Alaska Anchorage. This message sponsored by UAA.
The last fuel barges of the season showed up in Bethel late last week, which is dropping the prices in some communities in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Unleaded gasoline in Bethel dropped 16 cents down to $5.59 a gallon. And heating fuel in the region's hub went from $6.27 down to $5.75 a gallon. That's a 52-cent drop. Brandon Leary, manager of the region's biggest fuel supplier, Crowley Marine Services, says they have most of their fuel in for the winter, and these new prices will most likely remain in place until June of next year.
This will be set till next spring, till we get our spring deliveries in.
The prices are still expensive and are a lot more than Bethel residents paid last winter. Last year, gas in Bethel was set at around $4.80 a gallon, about 80 cents less than this winter's price. Heating fuel is about $1.70 higher than it was a year ago. The reason for the recent drop in price is the fluctuating cost of a barrel of oil. It went from a high of about $150 a barrel to a price that's been hovering closer to $100. Leary explains it this way.
Well, in the spring, you know, price of oil had shot up way up. So when we loaded for Bethel, we bought that real expensive fuel. And, you know, of course, everybody knows we had the big price jump. And throughout the summer, the price of oil was steadily dropping. And, you know, now the price of oil was down substantially when we got our final loads. You know, and then that averages in with the fuel that's in our tanks, and that's how we come up with our pricing for the winter after transportation costs are figured in and everything else.
As for the region's 56 villages, most have already bought and paid for fuel at an agreed-upon price. But, Leary says, some of them are still waiting on their fuel to be delivered. He says some fuel prices in the villages will depend on when the barges can make it there, if at all.
We've been having a tough time this year with the shallow water. We couldn't make it to McGrath, so they got shorted up there. We've been back in the lake doing deliveries to Nanop and Kasigluk and having a tough time back there, getting stuck. And it's been a tough summer on the river, or tough fall anyway, and you know, that all factors into the pricing.
Crowley Marine Services in Bethel buys its fuel from either Anchorage or Nikiski. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
The Alaska Volcano Observatory confirms they have seen some increased steaming from Redoubt Volcano on the western side of Cook Inlet. KBBI's Mike Mason has the story.
Redoubt Volcano is located about 51 miles east of Kenai within the Lake Clark National Park. And the last time the volcano erupted was back in 1989 and 1990. In mid-September, a pilot flying downwind of the volcano reported a strong hydrogen sulfide odor that prompted the Alaska Volcano Observatory to send up an observation flight on September 27th. Chris Wade Thomas is a geologist with the observatory, which is charged with monitoring all of the volcanoes in the state of Alaska.
What has been observed by air are some melt pits in the upper part of the glacier near the summit crater. These likely reflect a slight increase in heat flow. It's something to keep an eye on.
The scientist on the observation flight noted that the openings atop the 1968 and 1990 domes were steaming more vigorously than when last observed in mid-August. Apparently, those on board the flight noted a distinct hydrogen sulfide odor, and there was an instrument on board to measure sulfur dioxide. However, AVO says no sulfur dioxide was measured. Again, Chris Way Thomas.
Next time the weather looks good for a couple days, we're going to do a more robust gas sampling mission and try and collect other gases, carbon dioxide, hydrogen sulfide, and sulfur dioxide gas if they're present. So we'll be measuring those if they're there, and that will tell us a little bit more about what might be going on.
AVO notes that a small number of rock falls and other surface events have been observed at the volcano through the existing seismic network, but they are within the range of normal background activity. Way Thomas says they would see some seismic activity if the volcano was preparing to go active.
Despite the melting and possible gas emission, there's no corroborating seismic evidence to indicate the volcano is waking up.
Redoubt Volcano remains at aviation color code green and alert level normal, and AVO expects that if the current low-level unrest does lead to an eruption, they would see a strong increase in seismic activity first. In Homer, I'm Mike Mason.
Recently, an Anchorage man achieved a dubious distinction. He was the first to be captured and arrested by Anchorage police for trying to steal a bait car. Actually, he was arrested by the police but captured by the car. KSKA's Len Anderson explains.
A few days ago, 27-year-old Dwayne Jones spotted a parked vehicle that apparently proved irresistible. Unfortunately for Jones, he gave in to temptation and decided to take one of APD's new bait cars for a ride. Police Department spokesman Lieutenant Paul Honeman describes what happened after the uninvited driver entered the vehicle and eased behind the wheel.
As soon as the vehicle's
tampered with and the ignition is activated, there's a series of alarms that were alerted here at dispatch. And in this particular case, it was when the officers got in position, located the car, and were just about to make the traffic stop. They had notified dispatch to disable the vehicle, and at that point, everything from the minute the vehicle's tampered with, there's a recording, both audio and video. And so we were able to, you know, later, of course, we were able to grab the recording, and you can actually see the looks on their faces and hear the conversations that are actually going on inside the vehicle.
Thanks to National Insurance Crime Bureau funding, APD now has a number of these technically sophisticated bait cars to help reduce Anchorage vehicle thefts. According to Horniman, the weekly auto theft rate in Anchorage ranges from 14 to 20 vehicles a week. In cities that use bait cars, auto theft rates have declined by about 40%. Horniman says they received the vehicles a few months ago and have now worked out an effective procedure, including training the officers how to respond effectively to electronically instigated felony alerts.
We actually have several vehicles, but this particular vehicle we've had out for several months, and so we have different vehicles that we'll rotate through. We try to track it more than one at a time. Where it's kind of new to us, and we're trying to experiment with the successes of it.
Until Jones went for his recent drive, the bait cars had attracted only a few tampering nibbles, but no felony bites. To the wary thief, there's nothing to give the vehicle's undercover status away. No double X license plates, antennas indicating the hidden recording devices, let alone the equipment allowing police to remotely track the car, shut down the engine, and lock the doors. As Horniman says, they're desirable but nondescript. When the police stopped, remotely, the bait car at 31st and A Street, there were two men inside, but only Jones was charged.
Mr. Jones actually picked up an unknowing person, actually was offered him a ride shortly after he'd stolen the vehicle. He was also contacted by police at the time, and once we verified his story that he simply got in the car, the guy had the keys, didn't know that it was stolen, had no clue it was stolen. He was very, very shaken by the whole incident, not knowing why the other person was being stopped and had several officers surrounding him, a felony traffic stop.
This is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Mike Mason in Homer, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson, Steve Heimel, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The 8th Annual Aviation North Expo is happening at the Fairbanks Princess Riverside Lodge October 16th through the 18th. This 3-day aviation conference features travel and lodging discounts, FAA certification, a trade show, and networking opportunities. For details and to register, visit aviationnorth.org or call toll-free 877-427-5599. This message sponsored by the Aviation North Expo.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.